tell me about when you first heard about the story of Mike Rust and why it was that you decided to go ahead and try to do a documentary.
Well, I first heard of Mike Rust's disappearance quite a long time after it happened, actually. I was living in East Africa. We were working there. And it was only after we moved back and had our son that I kind of learned more about just the fact that he had disappeared, you know, and he was kind of a pivotal figure growing up here in Salida, Colorado. So I kind of wondered why no one had been talking about it more, no one had been telling his story. And that's kind of what enticed us to start, you know, start looking into telling the story of the disappearance of Mike Rust, simply because no one was talking about it.
For those who don't know, can you talk a little bit about the disappearance? And obviously that's a part of the film, but if you can kind of just give a rough outline.
Well, no one really knows the exact details, of course, of what happened when Mike Rust disappeared. I think from the police report, the details are pretty scanty. They think what happened is that some people had broken into his house, and he perhaps saw them off in the distance when he got home. He called a friend, said he was going after them, saying that, you know, he was going to track them down. He'd seen these tracks in the dirt. And so he jumped on his motorcycle. And it's thought that he, at some point during that search, he caught up with them. And what was left afterwards were some scuffle marks in the dirt, his vest that he'd been wearing with some blood on it, and a broken pistol butt, a pistol that had been stolen out of his house. And that's really, no one has seen him again since then. So those are all the details that are known, which isn't much, you know, in a valley that's the size of Connecticut, a huge valley. And I think there are only a handful, less than 10 law people total that are working, you know, covering that whole area. And some of those guys are working part-time. So they're really, law enforcement doesn't have the resources they need to cover such a gigantic area, you know, which ranges from 14,000 foot peaks down to, you know, a huge farming area in the valley floor across to the beginning of the San Juans in the west.
To back up, let's talk about who Mike Rust himself was. When did you first find out about Mike Rust, and what can you tell us about his life?
So I first met Mike Rust and his business partner, Don McClung, when they moved to Salida in the mid-80s and opened Colorado Cyclery. And at the time, you know, Salida wasn't this popular mountain town like it is now. It was a sort of post-mining, post-railroad town. The mines had closed down, the railroad was closed down. And it was pretty empty. Downtown was empty. You could buy buildings, you know, for $8,000-$10,000. And these guys moved in because it was cheap, you know, because it did have a great mountain environment. And they sort of started to change the paradigm of what was happening here, you know. They were some of the first mountain bikers that ever moved in. And, you know, people started watching what they were doing. These guys were out there having what looked like more fun than the rest of us, you know. So as an impressionable teenager, I think I was, you know, 15 or 16 at the time, I saw this going on and I said, wow, I want to be part of that. But at the time, I didn't know that Mike was already a famous mountain biker, you know, sort of helping set the scene over in Crested Butte with Don and Steve Cook, two other Hall of Fame mountain bikers, where they were really, you know, taking just the parts that were available before, you know, before mountain bikes became produced, before they were actually made mountain bikes. They would take the old cruiser bikes, like the paperboy bikes, and then retrofit them with whatever parts they could find, derailleurs from road riding or motorcycle parts or whatever, to make them suitable for the mountains. So he was kind of known already as the master of the conversion, making these new style bikes out of old bikes long before he ever came to Salida.
My understanding is that they were called clunkers originally. Is that your understanding? I didn't hear it mentioned in the film.
Yeah, I think they did call the early bikes clunkers for sure, probably because they clunked along and were really noisy when you rode them. They didn't have any suspension or anything, so it's just a bunch of old parts stuck together. And then, then they became known as mountain bikes later on, you know, which is all kind of funny because I think the first mountain bikes were really probably ridden, you know, 100 years ago. When there weren't any paved roads and people rode them everywhere anyway.
Right, when bikes were designed to ride on dirt roads, really, which is what, in a lot of ways, they went back to. There's this saying that comes up in the film, the bicycle has a great past ahead of it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think mountain biking started the first day that someone rode one off the boat in America. So, and then, you know, sort of modern mountain bikes, like the 26-inch wheel, I think it only became standard because that's what sort of the old Schwinn paper delivery bikes had. And so that's kind of what they started modifying, you know, in the 70s and 80s. And it kind of stuck for a while. But one thing that Mike Rust and Don McClung did at Colorado Cyclery is they were, you know, experimenting with old wheel sizes, the new ones, with the geometry, the shapes. And they really, in this little dingy workshop they had in Salida, were designing some of the top mountain bikes of the time.
Talk about the making of the film. I know it's been in production for many years, and I know you had to take some time off. What kind of obstacles did you face in doing this, and challenges in terms of telling the story?
Yeah, it was a difficult story to tell in film for a number of ways. You know, one way was that he's missing, of course, and so there is no ending to the story that's satisfactory, I think, for a lot of people, including us. And, you know, while we're making the film, it took us about 2.5 years to finish it. And, you know, I think we're always hoping in the back of our mind that something would happen that would provide some resolution, you know, to the story.
You're showing the film around the state. Is part of your hope for it at this point that it might dislodge a new lead?
It's a good question. You know, we didn't make the film to try to solve the mystery. We made the film to... Yeah, to honor Mike's legacy, to honor, you know, Colorado's place in the sport of mountain biking, but to also to get people to talk about it again, because, you know, it's, I think there are a lot of people that go missing in Colorado, and I think the families are left with just this total uncertainty the rest of their lives. So I think part of the Rust family's desire was, you know, to open the story up again, to get it out there, and hope that they do have some sort of resolution. You know, it's hard to say, you know, I think the brothers have different goals for it, and I can't really speak for them, but I think, you know, some just want to find out what happened to Mike, where his body ended up, and aren't too concerned with who did it, while I think other brothers may be more concerned with who did it.
Beyond the screenings you have planned in Colorado, where do you plan to take the film, and do you plan to distribute it internationally, try to get it on Netflix? What are your plans for it?
Our plans for the film are to, you know, to show it to as many people as possible. But yeah, you know, our first goal is to show it around Colorado for sure, because this is sort of the heartland of the film and the people that are most interested in it. So we've been scheduling shows, anything from really small shows to big shows throughout Colorado. But yeah, eventually we'd like to get it on video on demand on something like Netflix, so it would be available to as many people as possible.